Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. It's your future. Let Zurich help you protect it. Talk to us today about life and serious illness cover.
Thank you, Hugh, for that. Now, we heard earlier in the programme from Natasha O'Brien, the 24-year-old Limerick woman who was beaten unconscious in a random street attack in her home city 2 years ago. A serving soldier, Cathal Crotty, was handed a fully suspended sentence last week. We spoke with Natasha and Maeve McLaughlin Doyle earlier in the programme. The Defence Forces have commenced internal proceedings against Private Crotty. But what are the options for the DPP if there's an appeal in a case like this? And what decision-making goes into sentencing? For more on this, I'm joined now by Senior Counsel Tom O'Malley and retired Professor of Law at the University of Galway as well. Tom O'Malley, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Corbyn.
If we speak generally now, I just wonder, what are the parameters that are taken into account when a judge is formulating a sentence?
Well, the first and most important consideration is the maximum sentence that applies by statute to the offence in question. For example, in the offence that we're talking about in Limerick, which was assault causing harm, the maximum is 5 years imprisonment. Now, that has recently been increased to 10 years, but that new maximum doesn't apply retrospectively. So the maximum was in that case, 5 years. Now, in addition to that, the basic principle of sentencing in this country is proportionality, which means that the court has to take into account not only the nature of the offence, but also the circumstances of the offender. And that means that courts effectively adopt a two-stage approach when they're selecting a sentence. First of all, they select what's called a headline sentence, which is the sentence that would be appropriate if only the gravity of the offence itself was taken into account, in other words, the entire circumstances of which the offence was committed. And then secondly, they have to make any necessary adjustments to that to reflect the offender's personal circumstances. Now, those adjustments are usually mitigating rather than aggravating. So usually there will be a reduction in the headline sentence to reflect factors such as whether the person pleaded guilty, whether they have previous good character, whether they have expressed remorse, whether they have made restitution or compensation or factors of that nature. And that would eventually bring them then to what is the ultimate sentence to be imposed.
Then when a judge has to is formulating and reflecting on a sentence and he has heard, for example, a character witness statement and he's also heard a victim impact statement, how does a judge weigh all of those things up generally?
Well, there isn't, as it has always been said, any kind of mathematical formula for doing so. But there have been a lot of developments in sentencing in this country over the past decade, and especially over the past 5 or 6 years, because the senior courts, namely the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, have established guidelines for quite a number of commonly prosecuted offences, such as residential burglary, rape, manslaughter, and a few others. And essentially what those guidelines do is that they set out various categories of seriousness, typically three, let's say low, middle, and high, and they indicate the kinds of factors that should influence a judge in deciding which category a particular offence should be allocated to. So, for example, in a case like assault, well, the more serious the injuries that were inflicted, the higher the category into which that particular offence will be placed. So those guidelines, you know, are of considerable assistance. There's also, of course, even though it's maybe something in abeyance at the moment, under the Judicial Council Act of 2019, there is set up a body called the Sentencing Guidelines and Information Committee, which is charged with setting out more formal guidelines for the sentencing of individual offences. Mm-hmm. However, they haven't started coming on stream yet. But for the moment, we're relying on judicially developed guidelines, okay, and they can be a very considerable help to judges in deciding on sentence. But again, it must be remembered they're only guidelines, and there can always be exceptional circumstances in any case which will justify a trial judge in departing from those guidelines.
Are fully suspended sentences, Tom, are they common?
Well, it's hard to say if they're common. It depends really on the nature of the offence. They're quite uncommon for serious offences. Normally for crimes of violence, let's say for drug dealing offences, for sex offences, they would be probably the exception rather than the rule. they're not entirely ruled out. What would be far more common for in those cases would be a part suspended sentence, whereby the person is given, let's say, 4 years imprisonment, but the last year or 18 months may be suspended. The rationale being that if you do suspend the final part of the sentence, it provides a kind of an incentive for the person to remain crime-free and to try to get their life in order, because they know that if they don't, if they re-offend, well, then they'll be returned to prison to serve out the remainder of that sentence. But, as I say, for serious offences, crimes of violence and so forth in particular, fully suspended sentences would be quite unusual.
Oh, okay, so I could ask you the follow-up question, the corollary there. What's the rationale behind a custodial sentence, generally?
Well, the rationale behind a custodial sentence, by which you mean, I take it, where the person goes to prison for a defined period, it's primarily punitive. It's primarily punitive. It's punishing the person for the offence in question. It may also serve a deterrent purpose, in the sense that it may, or even though the research on this shows that prison sentences don't deter at all as much as people imagine, but it may have some deterrent impact. And also, in an ideal world, it would have some rehabilitative, it might provide some opportunities for rehabilitation for the offender if suitable facilities are available within the prison system. I suppose one of the things that's worth saying at the present time is that our prison system is operating way beyond capacity. The prison numbers have grown enormously over the past year, so that according to the most recent prison statistics, which are now published on a daily basis, I think it's operating at something like 112% capacity. Now, of course, that means that it can be difficult. The prison authorities are no doubt doing the very best they can. But when
and
you have
does that play on the mind?
Nature,
to cut in just on that point, then the overcrowding of prisons does that play on the mind of a judge in any way? There's so many cases up and down the country when they're deciding to impose a custodial sentence or not.
I'm not sure about that, because, strange enough, despite the level of prison overcrowding, it's something that's getting hardly any publicity at all, and there's very little public awareness of it. But certainly, if it becomes widely known, it's something that could quite legitimately influence a court, in the sense that when you're looking at the severity of a prison sentence, it isn't just the length of the sentence that counts, it's also the nature of the conditions in which it is served. So, you know, a two-year sentence could have a radically different impact depending on whether it's served in very humane conditions or in very overcrowded and harsh conditions. So it's something that a judge could certainly take account of. But certainly it's something that would, if you like, save a person from being imprisoned if, you know, the nature of their offence is sufficiently serious that only a prison sentence can adequately punish it.
A point was made earlier in the programme that maybe there's a need for more education about trauma among legal professionals. I mean, do judges have to undergo any kind of training or let's say, continuous development like doctors to update their knowledge? Does that happen?
Well, yes, they do. Judges have regular conferences. But in addition to that, under the Judicial Council Act that I mentioned there earlier on, another provision of that act is that it has a specific provision for judicial education, and there's a committee set up to that effect. And obviously, you know, the judges have an awful lot more to do than sentencing, so there's a very wide range of issues at which, because of, you know, all the changes we have with it all, there's a very wide range of issues of which they have to keep up to date. But certainly trauma is something that has been achieving a great deal of attention, certainly at academic level and maybe at a kind of a social science level over the past few years. It's something that judges, I think, are becoming progressively aware of. But it's also, of course, something that they have to treat cautiously. So generally speaking, in a case where it's being claimed, you know, that the complainant, the victim, is, you know, suffering from trauma or has suffered from it in the past or maybe continuing, very often is continuing, it's usually better if there's some expert evidence produced to that effect from a psychologist or a psychiatrist or whoever the appropriate person may be. When that's done, well, then a judge has a much more firm basis on which to reach a decision as to what impact that should have on sentence.
Okay. Has it happened often, Tom, that if a sentence is passed down, that the DPP might say that that seems lenient to me, I'd like to challenge it? Is that open to the DPP? What's the procedure there?
Well, very much so. That's a system that has been there for just over 30 years now. It was introduced in 1993, and it happens quite frequently. I mean, the number of cases that the DPP has been taking has increased progressively over the years, and indeed the success rate of the applications has also increased progressively over the years. So it isn't at all unusual that if the director reaches a conclusion that his sentence is unduly lenient, that she will refer that to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal, if it decides that it is unduly lenient or that the judge made some error of principle or of law in determining the sentence, they are at liberty to quash the sentence and then to reimpose whatever sentence it, the Court of Appeal, considers to be appropriate in the case. So we quite frequently, or not infrequently, let's say, see the Court of Appeal increasing sentences that they find to be unduly lenient.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for sharing your knowledge, your expertise on this. Senior Counsel Tom O'Malley, Míle Buachas Leatsa Sochlort Intrunona.